What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Writer Stuff with yours truly, John Stamp. It is official. Ty Benhoff is once again free to roam about your Kindle, paperback, bookstore, book club, wherever and however you take your fiction. He is ready and psyched to lead you on a heart-stopping ride through Indonesia. Literally, that part is true. I did let him drive. No spoilers involved because I think you should read the book, but I did let him drive, and some stuff got broken. Some people got their feelings hurt, and Ty may or may not be persona non grata in the fine country of Indonesia from henceforward, which wouldn't be the first time an NCIS agent got PNG'd from a country. That's another story for another day. You just have to read more to find out, see how everything worked out and overmatch. So how's that for a suspenseful teaser? Take that home with you. But seriously, Overmatch is out now, shooting towards the bestseller list as we speak. And thank you all for the support, the comments, and just the good vibes you've been sending me for it. I appreciate it. And tonight we are going to be talking thrillers and historical fiction with author and podcast host Travis Davis. Travis joined the U.S. Army at 17 years old as an armored reconnaissance specialist. He was stationed in various forts in the United States and Germany. During his three tours in Germany, he conducted hundreds of border patrols along the East and West German border and the Czechoslovakia-West German border. I was pretty sure I was going to mispronounce Czechoslovakia, but I got that one out.
There's a joke in there, too, by the way.
There's got to be. Travis saw firsthand communism and the oppression of its citizens. He retired from the U.S. Army, where his last duty station was with the 2nd Armored Cav Regiment at Fort Polk, Louisiana. He's a lifetime member of the Sergeant Morales Club and received multiple awards, including the Meritorious Service Medal and 5 Army Accommodations. He's written 2 Team Texarkana thrillers, Flames of Deception and Cobalt. His newest release, 1 of 4, a World War I historical fiction I'm really looking forward to, comes out in May. And as I said earlier, he's also the host of the Author Ecky podcast. So, Travis, thanks for joining me.
All right, thanks, John. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, between the podcast and the writing, it's you kicked it off in the thriller world, and now you're sliding over into historical fiction. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the historical fiction, World War One. Yeah. I love that. I love that time frame. It's just a scary thing to think about every time you read something about it. It's hard to even imagine that kind of scale, right?
Yeah, it's amazing because we feel the repercussions of World War One today, with the boundaries that were set up after the war. You know, who got what? How, you know, Iraq, Iran, some of these countries that never existed before were now countries. So I was in the middle of writing my third book for Team Texarkana series. And I just had this idea. I've always been interested in World War One here lately, very interested. So I would love to write a World War One, but write something that nobody has ever written, and not just about combat, right? Mm-hmm. Not just about the brutality or anything. So what I did a lot of research, and the book is called 1 of 4. The World War One through the eyes of an unknown soldier.
Yeah.
And what it starts off in the preface talks about how the soldier was selected to go into the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in World War One.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And it was the soldier was 1 of 4 caskets that was chosen. And they were each of those soldiers, unknown soldiers, were taken out of the 4 different World War One U.S. Cemeteries in France, and so they were made sure they were unknown. They couldn't identify. They were made sure they were U.S. soldiers by the uniforms, and they made sure they were killed in combat. That's mm-hmm. the criteria.
Yep.
And then in 1920 or so, I believe 2021. A Sergeant Younger was selected to choose 1 of 4. And this is true. He chose one of the caskets, put a white spray of white roses on it. And that soldier was then taken across the ocean, the USS Olympia, and placed in the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier after one day or so in the rotunda of the Capitol.
And so that, is that those, the, sorry to interrupt, but is that the process? Is that the procedure for
World War I? It was.
Wow. Okay.
And that was the same process that the French and English used. So we didn't invent it. And so those three remaining were then placed in the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, U.S. and they are there today. Mm-hmm. So the premise is that, this part's fiction. And then when Sergeant Younger selected the casket, as he walked, you know, several times around him, but he was drawn to one and a feeling that he hasn't felt in years. And so then it goes into the next part about a French girl, you know, ravaged by war, sitting watching American soldiers go across a battlefield, right? And she sees this one soldier. They start getting hit with artillery and machine gun fire, and sees the bravery of the soldier trying to protect his fellow soldiers, his comrades. Mm-hmm. And the artillery is coming in, and she sits back. She puts in the back of the wall. She screams, "Stop! Stop! Stop!" And as the artillery wanes and the machine gun fire stops, there, she looks up, and they're decimated. So she runs out of the house. She knows a little first aid. She loves the American soldiers, what they're doing. She runs out there and tries to help, and the carnage is beyond what she can believe. And so she says a prayer, goes into the crater, tries to help. They're dismembered. I mean, it's just terrible. And laying next to one of the soldiers is a diary. And that diary has been unscathed from the artillery, but they can tell it's been worn. So she takes the diary because she hears something, take me, I'm all right. I'm not in any pain. You know, she feels this stuff. So she takes a diary, takes it back home, waits for American patrol to come by because she wants to tell them what she saw, the brave act of this soldier. It was unbelievable. So the patrol comes by, and in the patrol is Sergeant Younger. Sergeant Younger is tasked to go down and identify the bodies. One of the bodies cannot be identified. Then that body is then buried in an unknown grave and then moved later on. That diary is the 104. That's his day-to-day from June 1917 to October 1918. That is the life of that soldier.
Wow.
That I'm just, you know, fictional. That is the soldier, uh-huh, in the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
That's wild. What a great premise.
He's spiritual. He goes from private to NCO. He loves his soldiers, the army. He loves what he does. You see him change over time. And it's just not about that. But, you know, then, you know, she hides a diary, and the father and son find it, who were estranged in a bookstore, you know, 100 years later.
Wow.
And that diary brings them back together by retracing the footsteps of that soldier. And they eventually make it all the way back to Arlington National Cemetery, where they leave the diary with the soldier.
Wow, that's crazy. That's a wild, what a great way just to start off, you know. And it, as you're saying that, you know, the idea of this girl watching this horror, you know, and it's just Europe. I mean, it's not like she had the poor luck of the draw. It was just everybody's backyard at some point. Right.
Right.
And,
right.
It made me think of, I remember learning about the Civil War and like Antietam, you know, when they first kicked off the Civil War, people would bring picnics and, the civilians would bring picnics and come sit on a ridge and watch the battle. And it's like not even, you know, just as a curiosity more than anything else. They weren't even rooting them on. They were just going to see what happens until a couple of them get shot. And they're like, this is probably a bad idea, you know. Right. But
no more picnics.
Yeah, no more picnics. But the imagery of, you know, of a, you know, young teenage girl just watching this and I don't know, man. How did that come to you?
I don't know. I've talked with my son. He goes, "Oh, Dad, it'd be cool," because I wanted to do it. He goes, "Wouldn't it be cool if the father and the son were found it and they were estranged?" Like, "Oh my God, that's great!"
Yeah.
So that's how I built it around it. And I've had a professor, SMU historian, factually check it, because what I did is I retraced the battles of the 1st Infantry Division, who were the first expeditionary unit when they went over, because we had no divisions prior to World War I. And then that formed the 1st Infantry Division. And I was in the 1st Infantry Division, actually my first unit in the Army in Fort Riley was 1st Infantry. But I wanted to make it not just about war. And the battlefield scenes are, I've been told, are exceptional. I mean, you're there. But I wanted to make it about the life of the soldier, the gas attacks or prepping for war, training, the bonds you build with soldiers, right? It's all of that. The cohesiveness of a military unit is amazing, no matter what time period it is. Yep. And that's what I want to instill in the book. And so far, I've the folks that have read it, I've enjoyed it.
It's such a such an important thing to just show that cohesiveness in those mm-hmm. circumstances. You get people from all over the country thrown together in basic training or whatever, and nobody cared. Like, all the garbage that infests outside society is just gone because they're all suffering together. They're all working together, and
they have to be.
And I dare somebody to get in the middle of them, right? Like, what was that? Was it where was that big brawl that just hit the news? I think it was it Marines or was it Army? I think it was mm-hmm. Austin, right? Austin, where somebody tried to mess with a couple Marines and they just took on the entire bar.
Oh yeah, so they were down in
and
Austin.
It was on camera, so it was like, that's even better. It's just so much fun.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say, because I mean, I had a scout platoon. I had myself, lieutenant, and 28 soldiers, and we had them, every color, background, your urban, rural, whatever, right? And I was 32, I think, at the time, and we were 18-year-olds, so it was all a mix. But the whole thing that we had a common language, right? We all could talk to one another in English. So, but now the Cold War, what the Soviet Union would do, the Soviet Union would put people from different areas of Soviet Union in their vehicles. So, for example, a BMP crew or BTR or whatever, they would have somebody that from, Siberia or Kazakhstan or wherever, but they didn't speak Russian. They did not want the whole crew to be able to speak Russian, because then they could get together and collaborate and rise up.
Yeah.
That's what we have to be careful of. Yeah.
Yep. That kind of thing is just insanity. I was, I did training with the Djiboutian gendarme once for like a week. Mm-hmm. And we had to do it through two different translators for Arabic, Afar, some Somalian dialect, French. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize it, but the entire week there's this one dude sitting there. And he's like, we're just like, all right, this guy just does not care about hostage negotiation. We're teaching him a hostage negotiation class.
Yeah.
And this dude he could care less. He's just sitting there in the middle of the classroom, not even paying attention. Not even like faking it. He's
right.
And we get into breaks like in the third day, and we're like, Lieutenant, what's up with this guy? And he's like, yeah, he doesn't speak the language. I'm like, which one? We're doing four. He's like, nobody speaks his language. It's like some way off, like Somali dialect that nobody spoke. So this dude couldn't even talk to his own team. It was hilarious.
That's so crazy.
He like didn't have a chance. So I was like, oh, I don't feel so bad for him then.
Give him some tiddlywinks or something. It's amazing that when you put people together, and they, it's like basic training, right? You're getting in there. I mean, everybody just like have no idea. And by the end of mine was 13 weeks. By the end of that, we could, shoot, move, and communicate. And that's something that I portray in the book. You could shoot, move, and communicate without saying a word.
Yep. Yep. And
signals, gestures.
Yeah. And to purposely leave the team aspect out of your small units, like as you said, the Russians do. How do you expect to win? How do you expect to function?
Look at Ukraine. I mean, their army's terrible. I mean,
And they won't talk to each other.
They don't know how to maneuver, right? If you take out the commander, the lieutenant, whoever, they do not know how to move. The beauty of the American soldier, Marine, Airman, whatever, is the ability to work as a team, but to think independently.
Yep.
And to be able to rise to the occasion when necessary.
And
that's the beauty of it.
To do that, that's not only the individualism, but the innovation is I think that's where we have it. I don't know how that becomes part of a culture. How is it that yeah. I guess, you know, there's probably others that have it, but it doesn't seem like they got the same strive for innovation and that independent thinking that the Americans do. I just
right.
You don't feel that in this, and I don't know if that's just a way we were built, you know, after right. like the revolution and having, you know, you come over on a boat with everything that belongs to you and in your entire world, and you just start heading west and figure it out as you go. I guess that can, mm-hmm. that might, yeah. maybe that led to our culture.
Yeah. There's some militaries where, you know, this guy, he's happy being a tank driver. He wants to be a tank driver for 20 years.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, in the American military, you up or out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, basically yeah. that's what it is. You progress up to a point, and then you progress again, and you do something different, and you do multi things. You do you're able to do multiple jobs, right? You become a driver, then you become a loader, then you become a gunner, then you're whatever. I was in an aero rifle platoon. You know, we got either tuck in by helicopter. Or out. We never got both in and out. I couldn't figure that out. Why could you pick us? You take us there. Why can't you pick us up? Why do we got to walk?
You want to walk there or you want to walk home?
Yeah. Yeah. No, come on. We're going to walk. I remember I had a lieutenant it was a infantry lieutenant at Fort Riley. And I think I was 18 years old. And this guy just got out of Ranger school and he was all second lieutenant, right? So he said, I volunteered our platoon to go to down to Eglin to be aggressors for the Ranger school for 45 days. It was in November.
That's a humid cold.
It gets cold. The Yellow River gets cold, and it gets cold quick. I remember we were in these RB-15s, and we had one person that their job was bailing water out. I mean, and then, you know, we're going across the bays, and, you know, the Rangers are attacking, and we kept pogey bait in our pockets. So, hey, man, I got some pogey bait. Because, you know, they get angry when they get hungry. And if they treat you good, you know, they take their pogey bait, but you can't get them to get caught. And it was great, but it was great because you see these young people, some are in college, right? Going through Ranger school.
Oh, yeah.
And it made you kind of feel good because there's some good leaders come out of there.
Yeah. It's, but yeah, man, that's just the, you know, getting back to the way you just arc this character through that, mm-hmm. yeah. through that war is just, and you gave him a year. So is it, you know, just to mark that through other people's like that callback kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. I can't wait for that thing to come out. That's going to be awesome. How did you settle on First ID and how did you decide what his trajectory was? Like, what did you have him see?
So I wanted to give him longevity in the war. And the only way would be the First Infantry Division, the first Americans to fight actually in Europe, come to the United States. So I wanted to do it because I didn't want to do like a battle. I wanted to give the reader how, you know, they were like, bully, we're going to war. We're going to kick the Germans' butt. We're going to be home in a week and rah, rah, rah. And then you see it that the Germans were a fierce fighting force. They had been fighting for years before the Americans got there. They would lose thousands of men a day and not care. So I wanted to give them that perspective of, there was actually a period of about 6 months, maybe a little longer, maybe 9 months, that the U.S. Army had to train with the French before they got into battle. And when they got into battle, the first ones that weren't commanded by U.S. officers, you know, Black Jack Pershing, it wasn't until Verdome or Sasson or whoever. That's when it was, when we kind of took over, probably July, August, 1918. So I wanted to give him a run up to that. And what I also mixed in the book is him meeting real life people.
Yeah.
That were monumental in today or in history. Mm-hmm. And him actually being a part of a operation that a lieutenant won the Medal of Honor. So nice. that's, you know, so I put it that the Medal of Honor story is true. Mm-hmm. So I did research on that because I wanted, you know, so he has that, all that diversity, and nowhere in there is his name, where he's from. If you said Travis, what's his name? I wouldn't even know. What's he look like? I don't know. You know,
that's so great.
I wanted to do that because he's married and has a son, but doesn't tell anybody because he wants no preferential treatment.
Yeah.
If his submission is, you know, going to kill him, he won't be able to do it. And he very seldom writes home. Very seldom gets letters from wife. He says it makes him too homesick. Mm-hmm. So, and I wanted to take him through that whole experience of, you know, the ups and the downs and the loss of life, and you know, how's he coping with it? And at the same time, Walter and Alex, the father and son, where Walter's a combat veteran, 20 years in the military, he didn't know he had some, you know, PTSD issues, and it comes out in the book, and his son helps him with that, you know? So yeah. It's real bonding about it, how father and son, and it's more than just a war book. It's an experience to read the book.
Yeah. And it's gotta be, just so much fun and frustrating for the reader. Cause if, like you say, okay, this whole thing comes from a diary that's found untouched. And I don't keep a journal or a diary, but how are there going to be descriptors of you in it? It's going to be, I did this, I saw this, yes, this pissed me off. The person writing it already knows who the character is, and it's for them. Exactly. So yeah, why would you be like, yeah, it was so nice to get my social security number, which is this. And you know, yeah, I remember my house, which was this. And I'm so happy to be 6 foot tall and 220 pounds.
Yeah. Right. And he never gives any of the names to his fellow soldiers.
It's awesome. Yeah.
And so he doesn't do that. And so I wanted to, I get emotional when I read it, and I wrote it because it brings up some things. I put myself in the book. And it was, it's hard to end a book anyways, really. This one was extremely tough for me to put his last words, because he doesn't know. Right.
Right.
Those are his last words. He doesn't know it.
Oh, that's wild. It's such a great way to end it. But man, and it's, I can't wait for that. What a great premise. It's just, and that's so original. I mean, I can't remember the last time something like that really came up. I mean, that the idea, I've seen it, but not in that context and with that kind of narrative.
I wanted to be very respectful, right? To me, my utmost goal was to be respectful, to, you know, soldiers, World War I, and that soldier laying in state at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. I did a lot of research on the Sentinels. The book is dedicated to them, the guards, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. I have a great scene in there where they go through it, because they go back in to Arlington, because they feel that there's a need, because the son can feel that soldier. For some reason, he has a connection to him. He dreams about him, but he can never see his face. And he can feel that, in the book when he reads his story.
Now
World War I, soldiers were given diaries to write, to write their, what's going on in the war.
But I don't think that practice should have ever stopped. I mean, that's cathartic. Yeah. I mean, I don't know it's if it'd be like an iPad now, but yeah, it's therapeutic to write, to keep it down. I mean, they still do the leader books, like every officer carries around those little green books with the like canvas covers on them. But I think everybody should have that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you should be able to write down, because that's one reason why they wanted the soldiers to do it, was because of it's therapeutic for the soldiers. Mm-hmm. And there's so many firsts coming out of World War I. Halloween. Halloween was, you never had candy associated with Halloween until World War I, because the generals or whoever needed a way to give the soldiers fast energy. So chocolate or the trench coat. That's where,
I never would have thought of that.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't that part of the, I'm not the best scholar of World War I, but wasn't that one of the first things that hit him? Like when they got there was like, everybody's in trenches and they're moving inches a day. And they're like, what the hell is this? Like, isn't that just completely foreign?
Yeah, it's trench, and the trenches were hell on earth. That's how the French depicted them. They were, some of the trenches had been back and forth throughout, you know, since the war started. So some of them, as the mud got deeper and deeper, but as they dug into it, they would find skeletons.
Ugh.
And the rats were horrendous, right? There was dysentery. There was lice. They had to cope with machine gun fire, which was terrible, right? I mean, that's the first real use of machine guns. Mm-hmm. They had to worry about bombs, artillery. They had to worry about gas.
Yeah, the gas. That's dysentery. A scary one for me.
Ugh. And then they had to worry about the Spanish flu.
Yeah,
that one time was killing more soldiers than combat.
Yep. Yeah, the
and he experiences that whole thing. He experiences the whole thing.
Wow. Yeah. Now, as we're talking about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, it just occurred to me, and I wanted to know, while you were researching, I don't even know what the ethics of this would be, but did it come across to you? And I wonder, it makes me wonder, I'm just having a thought experiment. I don't know if this would be actually right or not, but has there ever been a discussion of going into that and then taking DNA samples and running those remains?
Did I think that's happened. That I think that's happened.
Have in they done
Vietnam.
That?
Yeah. I think they did it to either World War II or Vietnam veteran.
Yeah.
And they zoomed him. And then he would reburied.
Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering. It just occurred to me because I honestly mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever looked into it that closely. I've been there to see the ceremony, which is, you know, very solemn.
It's amazing.
Yeah. There's some things I think every American should have to do. And I think you know, going to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and seeing that ceremony, you know, going to the Arizona, I think you have to, you know, that and and the 9/11 Memorial in New York.
Yep.
I think that should be, I don't know if we can instill something like that, but I think that would send a good message to every generation coming up, I think.
Maybe the folks that are donating billions of dollars to campaigns for political purposes, why don't they donate to a fund and for school kids can go and see these and maybe build some patriotic sense into these folks, because right now they have none.
Yeah, it seems like patriotism's the enemy at most schools. I mean, luckily, I'm in Georgia and I don't have that problem, but I've got the family in New York. I'm just like, what are you guys? I am baffled by some of the things that I hear coming out of New York State at this point. It's wild.
I used to live there. Yeah.
Still love you, New York. But I definitely don't want to, definitely not a big fan of your government right now.
Yeah.
But man, I can't wait till May to get my hands on that book. That's are you gonna, now that you've dipped your toe in the historical fiction, are you sticking with that? You got plans for another one? Or are you running right back?
I have a plan for another one. I didn't know, and maybe a lot of people did. I didn't know that, like 1918, we actually sent some soldiers into Russia to guard some trains or whatever. And they were there, I believe, till 1919. They're called the polar bears. But their conditions were horrific also. Imagine. So I'm thinking about, I got an idea to kind of weave something in there. So I'm looking at that. But to me, history's, you know, very, you know, it's interesting. World War One is definitely interesting. And then, you know, my two thrillers, suspense thrillers, they're more modern and deal more with the technology space.
Yeah, and it's good to, I think it's good to, I know the business people are going to be like, oh, it'll never work. But I'm a fan of genre hopping. Like over the last year, mm-hmm. I've just come to the realization that I need to genre hop for each book. Like Ty, you know, Overmatch just came out. Got my crime thriller, you know, Let Ty Loose for a little bit. Next one is going to be sci-fi. Following that, my first experiment in sci-fi. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but
that'll be interesting.
It's been fun to write so far. I can tell you that. I don't know what the end product's going to look like, but you know, if you're not trying to stretch it, then you know, since it's my thing, I don't really care, because I'm like, hey, I'm going to try sci-fi. Let's see what happens. You know, maybe it's Star Wars, maybe it's not. But you know, I'm going to follow that with getting back into my horror series with Jackson Cole, and then flip back around to Ty. And I just because I tried to last year. I tried to wrap up my third Jackson Cole book and write Overmatch at the same time. Mm-hmm. And man, those two channels in my head were just like, they're just causing static. Like it was just bringing everything to a hold. So I had to ditch one and focus on the other in that. And I just, but then when I got done, I got my idea for a sci-fi book, and I'm like, I'd start writing that, and it just feels like it washes everything out. So I can just, you know, clear the plate and then go back to the next, you know, keep going. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's going to work for you, but I enjoy it. I enjoy
switching. Yeah, I was halfway through the third book by Team Texarkana when I had mm-hmm. this idea. And I just, okay, I was at 50,000 words into it. And I stopped. And then I went and just focused 100% of my time in this. And then
what a tough choice. That's some discipline right there, man.
Then I'm going back to it. As I'm thinking about this other historical World War One historical fiction book.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's some discipline though to be 50 grand into the manuscript and you're like, yeah, I'm gonna take a pause and not have that.
Oh,
that
some people say that's ADD. So.
we can call it ADD, but for me, when I get to because I just got to 50K this week on the sci-fi manuscript on my first draft, and I think you start feeling that buck fever because. For me, I start getting to that 70,000 point and I'm usually getting ready to wrap it up so I can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's, if you use those kind of metrics or if you just let the story end, but no, I get to 50K and I'm like, man, I got a couple more months jamming this thing out and it's, and I'm into rewrites, you know?
It's yeah.
Like, but to pause it and shelf it, that's discipline. I call it discipline, not ADD.
But I felt called to this book. It was strange. Yeah. I just immersed myself. I mean, I think my family got tired of hearing me say, "Did you know World War One?" They were like, "Oh, here's something else."
Here we go.
A little tidbit of information.
Yeah, it is crazy how those ideas, those little sparks will come, and that's all you can think about. Like, I've got the notebook next to my bed, and like, I don't know how many times it's been 2:30 in the morning, and I'm like, "Holy crap!" And I have to get up, and I'm writing in the dark, so you know, when the light comes on in the morning, you're just like, what in the hell is on that page?
That's that Seinfeld episode where he writes that joke down on the bed. He looks at it the next day, he can't read it, and asking everybody, and they're like, so that's not funny. Or
what is that?
Yeah, what is that?
Is that English? Yeah. Because, I don't want to wake anybody up by turning the light on. So I'm just like, I'll be able to figure this out. And you feels right as I'm writing. And then the next morning, I was like, I think I just wrote Cyrillic.
I would need a crayon.
Yeah, right. Well, if I have crayons next to the bed, I start eating them. So I just so you mentioned Texarkana. When I was reading through Cobalt, the team. I really like the team concept you put together. Uh-huh. And whenever I see that, I wonder like how many of those characters have real life avatars? Like, as you're putting those together, are there folks from your old units or folks you used to work with that just they fit right in that slot, or how'd you come up with that team?
Yeah, there's definitely some amalgamation of folks that I know, family members, potentially, folks that maybe they know that I've met. So yeah, there is something to say about that, where because you can take their quirkiness, you know, and put it in a character or what they know and who you've met and or your experiences and kind of put it all in there. And I'm a very team oriented person. I don't like an individual out there. There's some very good books out there, just individual, but I think sometimes it's all a team effort. And some of the team members are more prevalent, but I like to try to make them all, kind of equal. And I started the team in Flames of Deception. It was the first book. So there wasn't a team. It was just three individuals that worked in the same building at the NGO or NGA. NGO, my God, they're a travesty in themselves. The NGA, and they were similar background, military backgrounds, geospatial type folks, military. They became a team. And at the end, they added another member of a team that was not even from the United States, but she her unique capabilities are amazing. And then in Cobalt, that team goes forward, but I break the team up where they do different missions at the same time, but they're all related. They just don't know it.
Oh, that's all. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And when you do that, like for me, like I kind of write. When I have like Ty's new thriller, it's I kind of write it like I'm working a case. Like, okay, here's the inciting event, here's the investigation, here's the wrap. Mm-hmm. But if you've got the way you've written, and I don't think I've written one with a plot quite that intense, but how did you keep those different lines together, and how did you move your pieces on the chalkboard in such a way that you could all bring them together when the time counts?
That's tough. It is. You got to make sure they all end at the same time, right?
Right.
Or if they're doing something in Mongolia and somebody doing something in Lake Como, Italy, and then there's some other people doing something in Washington, D.C., there are times, I use a mind map, some mind mapping software that I can do that with, but then I keep a lot of it all in my head. I don't outline. So I just kind of write off, Panzer, I guess that's what they're called.
Wow.
So I just keep it all in my head and work them all together. And I make sure that I, like from a chapter or within a chapter, I make sure that I bring back into the character, right? I got to bring this other character back. When do I do it? And I got to make sure that I rotate all that and then bring it together. The next book, I introduce Mary, who is a CIA operative, but she's also a trained assassin and a graduate of the CIA Culinary Institute of America.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, so she is a trained chef, and her method of killing is poisoning a food in Michelin 3- and 4-star hotels and restaurants, but they can never be detected the way she does it. So I bring her in, and the next book is going to be called Behind You, Chef.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. I like that team concept, Flames of Deception is when you bring the team all together, and then in Cobalt, just the way I think, I guess in Flames of Deception, cyber attack, right?
Against the Green Energy Grid in Northern Virginia.
Yeah. And how did, as far as coming up with your research, you've got, and in Cobalt, very timely because, Cobalt and those rare earth minerals are kind of what's taken over every EV, every bit of this new technology that we have. Yeah. So that fight is so current. That's what a great way to do it. But how did you fall on this? Did you come up with the team first and find a plot for them? Or did you, did something spark in your head? It's like, this is the problem, and I'm going to direct my team towards it.
Yeah, I thought of what would be kind of interesting to talk about, write about, because I've never written before. That was my first book. I'm 64 years old. I started writing 2 years ago,
Wow.
I had an idea, and I go, so I ran the premise by a buddy of mine who's my old platoon leader I've known for 30 years, just retired as a colonel. And he said, man, Travis, that's a good premise. So I sat down the next day and started writing it. And I wrote, this is what I want to do. I want to put technology into it, like satellite imagery and geospatial. But then I also mix that with boots on the ground, hand espionage, and what you got to do to get yourself dirty. Because you got to verify the information, right? Mm-hmm. Now you have to verify. Truth, but verify. And so I did that. And then I built that team around it. Because as I was writing it, I could see the cohesiveness of the team and how Tex, the leader, mature late 30s, early 40s, was a first sergeant in the Army, right? So he wears the same outfit every day, different outfit, but the same colors every day, because he doesn't want to have to take the time to pick out what color shirt he needs to wear.
That's right.
And that's a big joke around the NGA. Hey, Tex, what shirt you got on? Or new suit.
Yeah. Who are you wearing today?
Yeah. And then him, kind of level-headed, very smart, speaks Russian, Chinese. And then Will, kind of a little goofy guy, but extremely intelligent. He's got special forces training. He worked with them, but he was a 35 golf in the Army. Geospatial guy.
I was going to say, you're going to have to explain that one to me. I don't know what that is.
Geospatial is imagery, satellite imagery. And so he's very good at that. And he notices some odd activity in the Russian oil fields. Something's just not right. The flame coming out of the flare stacks isn't burning the right temperature as being burn off. So that's how it's a catalyst of that. At the same time, China and Russia are moving their forces around the world for no apparent reason to strategic choke points of oil, you know, through Laos, which China has a handhold now. And they can't figure it out because there's no reason for them to do that. And same time, China's starting to mess with the energy grid, but they can now pinpoint where to hit the grid for how long. And they know nobody notices the minute interruptions. But there's a caveat because, so you know, there's a good plot to that. So, and they all, you know, the Russians, they do, they create some very good ships that would, they create some, you know, some self-driving subs that submarines that mimic other submarines. They're one submarine, they can mimic a surface ship by the acoustic sounds of it and everything. It just throws everything off.
That's awesome.
They put one of their nuclear powered icebreakers into being able to carry infantry battalion, airborne infantry battalion, because Russia wants something that's theirs and they want it back.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing. And India is in on it too, because India has a big naval force. So India, Russia, and China, basically.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at it, it's kind of reflected in the way China's expanding their way around the, the Pacific theater, over the South Pacific. You're just building islands and completely invading other nations' sovereignty to do it and not caring.
Yeah, one of the things is
blackmailing most of Africa for their infrastructure.
Oh my God, yeah. One of the things is they said they're building something, and can Chinese even do that? And the Chinese guy goes, "We build islands in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah,
we can do whatever we want.
We don't have to negotiate with anybody. We just tell our people what to do.
Yeah,
and
we just
tell
them do it. Yeah. They do it. You know, we don't care about how much it costs. Yep. The Belt Road Initiative, right? I mean, that definitely something to sink for. Get countries in debt to them.
Yep. Yeah. And it's just that bill's coming due and people are starting to figure out this was a horrible idea. This money wasn't free.
And
the Americans
fixed.
Give money
nothing's
away
built.
For free. I can't believe it. Yeah.
And nothing's built. So that's
we should just stick with the Americans. They just give us cash.
Yeah. Truckloads.
Yeah.
That's a different story.
Truckloads, no audits. You guys are wide open. I'm always so proud of how much of my tax money goes to other countries instead of helping the people who need it here.
I think we should be able to vote when we do our taxes, what countries we send it to. And one of them is going to be back to the United States.
Yeah, if I could vote, I'd probably send it to Georgia, the state of Georgia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I rank where I'd like my tax money to go to?
That'd be
pretty sweet.
Exactly.
That would hurt the pocketbooks of a whole lot of people in Washington, though.
That hurt a lot of these NGOs.
Yeah, NGOs is fun. You got unofficial government agencies the fact that that acronym even exists and the people aren't just like, "Are you shitting me?"
Yeah.
how arrogant do you have to be to actually just have a non-governmental organization?
Yeah.
And tell
and
people
that's
about
actually
it.
In my next book. I talk about they're terrible.
Oh yeah, this is like, come on, and I mean all that stuff. The deeper you look into that, like, just the way that America is just used by the international community, and how we love being used by the international community is staggering to me.
Well, I think it goes down to look when a politician leaves office, where do they go? They don't go back to their home state they've been representing for 20. Whatever years, they stay in the DC area.
Yep.
Right? Because that's where the money's at. They're not, I'm convinced that once they get there, they get soiled, right? And there's something, either dirt on them or something, because they just lose their scruples.
It's that mindset. I think it's that DC mindset that, everybody's in there and everybody speaks the same language, and everybody, suddenly the longer you're there, the more you realize that those people that are, you know, the people who are funding all this through their tax dollars, they actually have no idea what's they have no idea what's best for them. But why are we listening to these people? Let us just handle it. And so they just do through they just that administrative state. Just every you get into that mindset that you know better than these rubes out in the middle of the country. And let us just handle it. And it's like,
it's hard.
That's why anytime somebody talks about diversifying and kicking agencies out of DC and spreading them out, I'm all for it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
that the agriculture ought to be in Kansas somewhere, you know?
And, right. yes. Yeah. Yep.
Transportation, but, Detroit. I don't know, somewhere.
Yeah, but group thinks a dangerous thing, especially when it's the seat of government. You know.
That's, yep, I agree 100%.
That could roll down a conspiracy highway if we wanted to.
But, yes.
But it kind of rolls into cobalt. Didn't you? You dip into the idea of that Great Reset and cobalt.
Yes.
Yeah, and I haven't. I never really dug into the whole idea of the Great Reset. I've of course heard about it, but how fun was that to explore the feasibility of something like
it
that?
It was good. I mean, because it's a lot of stuff you can read out there, but a lot of it, you know, the book starts off with a rare form of cobalt is found in the Congo, and the cobalt is from a meteor crater. And what it allows the Chinese to do is miniaturize solar batteries that charge phenomenally quicker and last a lot longer, they miniaturize them. So they have an initiative, I named it 2030 or 2025, is to solar power their armored vehicles. But in order to do that, they coat them with a filament or a paint that is a solar collector itself. So they can run forever.
That's awesome.
In their tanks, and they minimize their crew from 4 to 3 to 2, a driver and a gunner. But what they've also done is they've created a mesh where individual tanks can get information from satellite, from UAVs, UCABs, and other tanks in the battlefield, and it's AI. So the tanks can maneuver to the best advantage of them. At the same time, these are rogue Chinese entities that are doing this, working with a group called the World Energy Revolutionary Group, which is a rich billionaire German living in Lake Como, that his goal is to create chaos where you have the have and the have nots. And that's his ultimate goal.
You keep people at each other's throats. They don't pay attention to what's actually ruining their lives. Yep. That's right.
Yes, exactly. And then it's got some pretty good twist in it. And you know, I do a tremendous, even for fiction, you do a tremendous amount of research, because it has to be like, okay, I can believe it. I know it's not true. And I have to tell people when I talk to about the books at book signings, they're like me, like, is this real? Like, it's fiction.
It's fiction, dude. It's in the fiction section.
Just fiction.
Well, did you read Cobalt Red? Because that's immediately what I think about when you go to the Congo. Did you ever read Siddhartha Kara's Cobalt Red? Uh-uh. Oh man, I first heard him on Rogan. I've reached out to him a couple times to get him on here, but he did a deep undercover journalist, like went to these artesian mines where they mine these rare earth minerals in Congo, and they're horrific. Just, you know, people digging.
Oh, they're kids.
Digging this high level pollution and these very caustic, very poisonous minerals and chemicals out of the ground with their hands, and little kids doing this. And it's, and also we can have cell phones. You know,
it's worse than blood diamonds. You know, when you think about that trade.
Yeah, absolutely awful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
But, man. But that's a wild one. But I love the premise of that whole thing. Cause I mean, if you think about it, that's, you know, we've always had that technological rise, but anybody who can figure out how to keep a tank going without having to stop for gases, that's pretty much it, you know?
And they've made it where not only is an automatic loader, they've created a loader that like a shotgun. So it has two points, man. You got, and it's electrical, not mechanical. So it's faster, and it's a rail gun. So everything goes out. And it can switch back like this and fire twice the speed of our best tank crews, probably 3 seconds, you know, or so. They can cut it down to 1.5 or 2 seconds firing rounds out of a rail gun.
Yeah, that's a new turning point that would just be technology always is the thing that turns every war we've ever had. So it's like, just to write that with it right on the edge of possible. I love that about that this thriller genre is keeping technology right on the edge, because technology is moving so fast that what you write today, next week can be ancient history. Right. All we need is Elon to say one thing, and it's like, well, okay, that's
true. Then
I'm basically writing in the 1980s now.
that full circle back to World War One. Mm-hmm. Where World War One was the first war that used, 19th, 20th century warfare. Mm-hmm. And look at it evolved out, the tank, the airplane. What things did we do away with? Gas, right?
Yep.
What happened? The machine gun. The Browning automatic rifle.
Yep. And think about the imagery of, this new horrible technology called the machine gun, but it's still being delivered to the battlefield by a horse.
Yeah.
Talk about right there. Seeing that page turn in history. It's like, oh yep. God.
Horse cavalry. They had a horse cavalry World War One.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Crazy. Crazy.
That's why it's so much fun to be an author. And you just picked this up at like 62, huh? Would you just retire? You weren't one of those guys that just walked around with a notebook, just writing down stories. You just, when you retired, were you just like, hey, I want to write a book?
I wouldn't retire. I was working full time. Okay. I retired about a year and a half ago, but then I got bored. Now I'm a monitor on a special education bus in the school system here. So I've got like 5 hours of work or six and 5 hours off or whatever. But so I do that. Yeah, I don't know. I tell people aneurysm, but that.
moments insanity. The voices in my head needed someplace to go.
I've created board games. I've created some software. I've done a lot of the creative things. I just might not try to write something.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's a fun challenge. I mean, I'm one of those guys that. I thought if I could figure out how to write books, I could be cool like Tom Clancy standing in a flight suit on a deck of an aircraft carrier. I thought that's what writers did. So since I was like 10 years old, I'm like, I'm going to be an author one day so I can maybe go ride an F-18.
We have caves. We live in caves.
That's right. But no, man, what a challenge to present yourself. That's just fun. And then when you tell people that you're writing a book, I don't know if you got the same thing. I told very few people when I was trying to write my first book. You tell, oh yeah, I'm writing a book right now. And they're like, sure you are. Right.
I get the same thing. They go, really? I've seen your writing.
I had a buddy when I first got my first publisher, when I wrote my first book, I was checking my email, and I'm just standing around at work one day, and I'm like, oh man, these people want to publish my book. He's like, and a buddy of mine, he's got some of the best timing ever. There's a decent amount of him that is part of Ty Benhoff. Just goes, you wrote a book? He's like, I didn't even think you could read. And he says this, we're in a group of like 12 people.
Yeah. Tell somebody, you got to finish. And I told some folks, hey, I want to write a book, and they go, yeah, okay. Sure, I had to finish.
You got to finish now.
Yeah. Got to finish.
Yeah. How's your book going? Can you imagine having to listen to that for 5 years straight? Yeah, how's your book going?
Well, you see, I'm driving the same car, so
exactly. I still see you every day, so clearly it's not going great.
Yeah.
Oh man. So exactly. So you're. We get to see more historical fiction after 1-4 comes out, and then Texarkana sticking around for at least another book. The podcast, Eki, Author Eki. And it's funny, before we started recording, I'm like, what does Eki stand for? You had to explain it to me. Author's Corner. I dig that. I dig it now. I was like, what does Eki stand for? Cause I was like, how am I going to introduce this? That's what, when we got together, I'm like, I was still working on my notes. I'm like, yeah, I got to ask him. I'm like, I don't even know how to pronounce this. So
Author Eki, yeah.
Yeah. Where'd the podcast come from?
Well, when I was, I wrote my first book, right? I was done. I was finished. And I go, I don't absolutely know anything about the publishing industry. I've never talked to any writers or nothing. So I said, what a better way than to start a podcast? So I started it 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago. I started the podcast. I've had 57, I still got some I have to produce, 60 or so episodes. Nice. And so, because I want to be able to share things with people that may think about writing, or people that already have written a book, but you know, marketing aspect of it, you know, getting it out there. What, how do you talk about your social media? So I wanted to be able to give folks back some things that I was learning, and hopefully help somebody, you know, tell their story. Because somebody's out there probably got the next War and Peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and save people some pain maybe, because it's yes. I'm going on 10 years as a novelist, and I would honestly say, and this just reflects my lack of overall intelligence, but I'm just like, in the last 3 years, I've been like, you know, I should probably figure out the business side of this. Like, I'm having a great time writing. Yeah, I love writing these books, but I should probably focus on actually selling them at some point.
It's <You know? laughs> a business.
Yeah. Like, so that's the same thing with the writer stuff. I was just like, this is so much fun. I love talking books with writers and readers. So I was like, why don't and you're having so much fun when you're a guest on a podcast. It's like, this is a blast. So I did the same thing. I came home one day from, I think I drove up to Charleston and was on Lively Charleston with Scott. And I come back, I was like, hey, Eric, I'm going to start a podcast. She's like, what? I'm like, don't worry about it. I'll figure it out.
I was like, okay, now I need all this stuff. But
now what?
But you're right. Writing, I look at it like a pie, right? Writing up an author, you had your third is your book. A third is probably editing, proofing, and everything. And another third, which is even, maybe even bigger than a third, is marketing.
Yep.
And how do you market? I have a finite amount of money, right? So how do I market effectively to be able to get the readers? Because you and I do not compete, right? There's enough readers where people aren't reading just one book a year, right? So that's why I think the writing community is so strong, because we're not competing against one another, even in the same genre, because people read multiple books a year. And I think that's what's good. I have never ran into an author that has told me, I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah, never, I haven't either. Ever. And that collaborative aspect. Some big names, too. Yep. I've yet to run into somebody who's given me a cold shoulder.
Not one.
Just because exactly what you say, it's just such a collaborative community. Everybody wants everyone to do good, because the more readers there are, everybody wins, you know?
Exactly.
Exactly.
My book could drive somebody else to read your book.
Yeah, they might. They, just because of a conversation, be like, man, I love Cobalt. I want to try Ty. I want to read about Ty Benhoff. I want to read about Cobalt. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's just, it's a weird thing. And I don't want to bore the people listening because they've heard it before. But it's such a rare thing to have. Total strangers can show up, you know, and just immediately click and immediately just start rapping and helping each other, you know, just because of that shared lifestyle that we have.
Yeah, I agree 100%. 100%.
Yeah,
it's awesome. Like basic training.
Right. Yeah. Except I think there's more booze. I didn't do basic training, but there's probably more booze when we get together as often.
Yeah. And everybody's not cussing.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was a reservist. I didn't have to do basic training. I got
that's all right.
Yeah, but man, Travis, I've been keeping you about an hour, and I try not to keep people too long.
All right,
especially when they got a lot of stuff going on. But before, so I'm gonna cut you loose. But I have the same question that everybody gets when they come on board Writer Stuff as a veteran. You see, you know, you're walking through the mall, or if the mall still exists, you're walking past, walking on the street, and you see this 18-year-old standing in front of the recruiter's office and just kind of thinking it over. What's your advice to him?
Do very well in the ASVAB. Learn what occupations are out there and find something that interests you and be ready to challenge yourself. Be ready to find something in yourself that you didn't know existed until you're put in a situation where you start having some primal instincts. But most of all is don't look just while you're in them. Look what happens when you get out. What can you do with the things that you learned when you get out? Everybody gets out or, you know, one way or another. Right. My advice is do your research. I mean, I was 17. I didn't do anything. When I told my recruiter, he drove me back home. He said, so what MOS did you pick? Right. I go 11 Delta. He goes, are you effing stupid? But I tell you what, I loved it. I did it for 20 years. I loved it. But people,
and at,
so yeah.
At 17, you're like, hey, what's the coolest job you got?
Yeah. As Captain sat next to me, said, you like outside? I go, I love outside. He goes, yeah, we go out and find, you know, you find the enemy and everything. I was like, oh man, yeah. And then my first time in Germany, you know, below zero, I'm like, this is not the outside that I had anticipated.
Yeah, exactly. Can we try this again in August?
But I, you know, my son was in the Army. I took him to a recruiter, right? And, he got out, he loved it, got out and had a great job in Northern Virginia. And it excelled. You'll be surprised. If you didn't excel in school, you'd be surprised how people excel in the military.
Yep.
That you never thought would excel in anything they do. So challenge yourself.
And I just that alone, go do something hard. Cause it's not easy to instill that in people to go, you know, get off the easy side, you know, and go do something that is going to cause you pain. And it's hard
cause you to sweat and
yep.
Yeah. Build confidence.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't know any other way to build that, but going to do something hard, and it's not always an easy thing to communicate to people. Right.
Right. No, I agree. 100%.
Yeah. Awesome, man. I appreciate it. And,
well, thank you, John.
Before we go, website, socials.
Yeah. It's, authortravisdavis.com. I'm on Twitter. I think it's Real TW Davis. Facebook, Author Travis Davis, and on Amazon, of course, so you look up my author page. 1 of 4 is out for pre-sale on ebook, so you can go out there and pick up your reserve your copy when it comes out in May, and then I'm excited to get the book out, and I think people are really, from my people actually, one of the beta readers said that it makes them, when their son gets older, they want to do some battlefield adventures and go look at some battlefields. So you'll never know what you get out of the book.
Oh man, I can't wait for 1 and 4 to come out. That's probably going to end up being some of my boys' summer, on my boys' summer reading list as a required reading.
And there's no profanity in it. So they didn't cuss in World War I. Basically, a lot of there's a lot of cussing amongst the soldiers. What they've told.
My boys have the undistinguished benefit of not needing a lot of cussing in the books that they read because they unfortunately have me. So,
you were working for the Navy, so
yeah, right, yeah. But yeah, thanks a lot, man. And
thank
and
you. Anytime, I appreciate you, it.
Anytime weekend. You want to come back on and chat, I am down.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Good night, everybody.